Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is June 24th, 2004. Today's session number is THM 2004-04. Today's speaker is Susan and Michael Thomas. The lesson for today is Middle East, especially Israel and Palestine, bread. Let's listen in.
We're going to change the schedule on you, and I hope in some ways it'll be a helpful change for you. We were going to be talking about bread and all that sustains us on this journey in life and the journey in particular and difficult places. Susan and I have been talking a lot, and we're going to try to lower our volume and listen to Palestinians and others who live in the West Bank in Israel. We're going to show you a film that just came out, produced by friends of ours, so it's a delight for us to see four or five people from our congregation in the film. But mostly it's Palestinian voices on the wall, on the erection of this barrier wall, wall of apartheid, this dividing wall, as the film is named. And I invite you to think about the people that you hear who live along the wall. Let me just ask you, how many of you live on farms or grew up on farms? Okay. So a number of you know something about our attachment to land. Those of us, I didn't grow up on a farm, but and those of us who didn't know something about the importance of place, such as Holden Village. And so you're going to hear about the importance of place, the importance of land. In one scene, Assam, a farmer in Jayus, says, "The land, the farm is like my child." And so it's a short film, and then we're going to have time to talk. It's a 23-minute film.
One of the reasons we wanted to show you this film was because it's an excellent resource, that 23 minutes, it would be something that you could get either on DVD or video to show to your congregation in an adult forum setting, an educational setting. Also, just to remind you that if you did a Sunday on the Middle East or Israel-Palestine specifically, in the Middle East as well, there are wonderful resources available through the ELCA's website, so you can work with that. It's not blurry like this normally, I'm sorry.
Hot demolition order, the inspector just ignore it. First tear it up and then it just started the demolition. Last year it demolished about 70 houses in East Jerusalem. This year in February, already more than 40 houses have been demolished, including this one.
בין שני עמים, הפלסטינים וישראלים, לא מגיעים לבית בן אדם שאין לו כסף, הוא חי בשני חדרים עם המשפחה מ-12 איש ופעלה בשטוח לגור בבית מבטון. אני יכול להגיד יותר מזה. אני יכול לשלוח מכתב, אני יכול לשלוח מכתב לעם הישראלי שיבוא לכאן לראות את הדבר הזה.
Since the founding of the State of Israel in 1948, Israelis and Palestinians have been fighting over the right to live on the land. In 2002, a new era of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict began, with the start of construction on a separation wall in the West Bank. While the Israeli government claims that the wall is needed for security reasons, Palestinians see it as a continuation of policies to drive them off their land.
The Israelis say this is a security wall. This is to keep the Palestinian suicide bombers from coming into the Israeli area. There is a little truth in this, but actually most Palestinians believe that this is not a security wall. This wall is to grab more Palestinian land and make it part of the State of Israel. The security is the alibi for grabbing the Palestinian land.
I think when I started to act against the wall and for other things, I didn't know that much about Palestinian society. I knew what was happening inside my own society. And I didn't want to live this way. I didn't want to be ashamed to say that I'm Israeli every time that I'm facing a Palestinian Israeli or a Palestinian in the occupied territories or anyone else.
8 years ago, newlyweds William and Wafa Sahouri dreamed of buying a house and starting a family. As their family grew, they bought an apartment in a Greek Orthodox housing project on the outskirts of Bethlehem. But shortly after buying their apartment, they were told that their housing complex was scheduled to be demolished to clear a path for the wall that was to divide Israelis from Palestinians.
The nightmare began when we're new here and we know that they have a demolishing orders affected all the project here. The Israelis said that we are building and we built our project here without any permission from the Israelis authorities.
With enough outcry from the Christian community, the Israeli government backed away from the demolition and now plans to encircle the housing complex with a fence.
Do you imagine that we are living in a small cage with a gate, like the zoo, like prisoner or like the zoo, just enter and get out through this gate.
You have to get the permission to go through that gate. We can't live a normal life. We only go to work, to school, and come back home. That's it. Even my children, they cannot go anywhere.
The Sahouris are not alone. The path of the wall being built by the Israeli government is affecting countless Palestinians. One United Nations report estimates that approximately 680,000 Palestinians, 30% of the population of the West Bank, will be directly harmed by the wall. Jamal Eid's family lives a few minutes outside of Bethlehem. They've been refugees since 1948, when Israel confiscated their land. With the construction of the wall, they've lost more land.
يعني نحن ساكنين هون كما جينا أرض هون ما أعلموناش لا من ناحية قانونية ولا من ناحية أي تصرف قانوني يعني هم أجوا حطوا وضعوا إيدهم على الأرض الجرافات العسكرية أنا شخصيا رجعتهم طلعتهم ويعني وضعوا لي البنادق وجها لوجه فعلوا لي إرجع ما في هذا قرار عسكري مصادرة في إمكانية إنك تحط محامي ويأخذوا جزء لكن وضع اليد يعني خلص يعني فيش إمكانية إنك تتصرف قانونيا يعني سرقوا الأرض هلا أنا علي ممنوع أدخل أخطف الزيتون ثمار الزيتون ممنوع أحرث أرضي وكون فيش لهم حدود لاستيطانهم لتوسعهم الاستيطان فيش لهم حدود يعني اليوم قالتهم 67 كشرعية دولية دولتين الدولة الفلسطينية لنا الحق في إقامتها حدود الرابع من حزيران مش رابع حزيران هذا جدار 2003
The escalation of violence on both sides of the conflict has made the peace process difficult. Suicide bombers claim revenge for attacks by the Israeli Defense Forces. The IDF, in return, invade Palestinian cities, targeting Hamas and Islamic Jihad militants in hopes of deterring suicide bombers. Few would deny Israel the right to protect itself from terrorism, but many question Israel's true motive behind building the wall.
The wall is an outcome of hatred and fear and history and lack of logic and deep horror that surrounds the Israeli society today because of the vicious terrorist attacks on kids, on schools, on coffee houses everywhere, without stopping for 1 second to think and to evaluate really what will this war do. It will just create more anger, more terror, more catastrophes.
The wall is being built on the Palestinian lands and is shifted from the 1948 borders that are the green line. It's looping like a snake inside the Palestinian territories, and it's being built near or opposite to the Palestinian built-up area. You see that the wall here was planned to grab much of the Palestinian land.
The boundary known as the Green Line was recognized as the border between Israel and the West Bank by the international community in 1949. Thus far, the planned route of the wall disregards the Green Line and dips deep into the occupied territories. In the northern part of the West Bank, in the district of Qalqilya, the path of the wall winds through farmland, separating Israeli settlements from Palestinian villages. While plans for the unbuilt sections of the wall keep changing, it's clear that the route of the completed wall in Qalqilya holds little resemblance to the internationally recognized borders.
The red line is the wall. Where is the wall? Here. Here.
Here. Here. Here. Here. Here. Here. Here. Here.
This is the green line in 1948. هيكل محافظة قرقيلية بشكل عام محافظة تحت زراعية بالدرجة الأولى لما بنلاحظ أنه أغلقت من جميع الجهات وبقيت مساحة صغيرة من الأراضي الزراعية حواليها أنه معناه وعزلها عن محيطها الكرة الموجودة انعزلت عنها وبالتالي هي مصيرها إلى الموت.
In the northern part of the West Bank area is considered as the fruit basket for the Palestinians. Now this war will separate those people from the lands, and the war will include those as the fertile lands of the Israeli side.
In my opinion, this is a continuation for the strategy of colonialization and building the settlements inside the West Bank, which they started in since the 70s. And the war is just the accumulation of this strategy to control the life of the Palestinians and to make them hopeless without future. Actually, this war is going to control the natural resources the Palestinians could rely on to build their own state and economy.
In response to the emergency water needs in the Palestinian villages, several groups, including Catholic Relief Services and Mennonite Central Committee, have partnered with the Palestinian Hydrology Group. Together, they repair water pipes damaged by the construction of the wall.
We noted that there is an emergency situation that the Palestinian families are facing through the last few months as a result of the war. The purpose of the project is to provide help for the Palestinian farmers who are separated from their lands by the separation wall, which is the Israelis. We are trying to provide them with the water.
All water resources in this village was taken. We have ingenious, as I said, 1 million cubic meter of water behind the wall. And now we don't have any drop of water from our resources. For this village also, like many other villages in the district and other districts, more than 75% of our fertile and good land was now either destroyed under the wall or seized behind the wall.
People is devastating. Already the Palestinians suffer from poverty and from economic catastrophe. The wall is going to add to this. When people are denied the right to have a job, when people are denied to get to their farms, when people are denied movement, this means their economy is going to suffer.
These trees were uprooted by the wall. For this farmer, they uprooted more than 70 trees like this. He couldn't feel the people's trees are rooted without doing anything for it. Therefore, he decided to bring them here in front of his house and try to recover them. Unfortunately, this tree was not recovered. We have 550 families here in Jigus. We could have 550 stories from this village.
Assam Khalid is one of the many farmers in the town of Jayus. He comes from a long line of farmers.
For me, the land, you know, as a farmer, it means to me that it's like a my child. There's no difference. My child and the land are the same thing to me.
Since the wall went up, Assam has not been permitted to reach his land. He was denied a permit to pass through the gate that separates him from his land for security reasons.
It's the first greenhouses over there. Also, this tree is mine. Beside the greenhouses, all this trees also is mine. This area is mine, my area. We don't support the terrorists, we don't support anything. We just want to live, just to live and to get a better life for our children in the future.
The relation between the farmer and his land is very important. It's not only his source of living, but all the stories of the people, dreams, is mixed with the soil.
اللي أرض متين دلون خلف الجدار العازل. هذه قطعة الأرض تسمى وادي المناسف وبحر المناسف من حوض رقم 2 235 شايف؟ وهذه أنا أملكها من مئات السنين عن آبائنا وجدودنا شايف؟ طبعا لما دخلت سمحوا لي في الدخول الساعة 1:30 تقريبا من البواب بليت متجه لعرضي. لما رحت هناك لعرض لقيتها تجرب هذا بقول له شو بتشتغل فيها؟ لما بقول شو بدك اياه؟ قلت له كلمني قلت له انا من اسلم صاحب الارض هاي. قالوا لا هذه مش الارض مش قلت لهم لا هذه الارض اللي بملكها انا بموجود عندي خرائط وعندي اخراج كيد وعندي كل شيء فيها وهذه ارضي. قال مين اذا ما حدا بتدخل معه؟ قلت لهم انا دخلت عن طريق مشروع عن طريق تصريح. اتصلت علي عن طريق محامي وجبت هي تصريح هذه الارض ما قلت لهم لا بدكم. قالوا هذه ارض اسرائيل. قلت لهم لا مش ارض اسرائيل. أرض إسرائيل من الخط الأحمر المتخذ أرض إسرائيل اللي جات عليها أرض من 2000 نشي هذه مش أرض هذه أرض فلسطينية كلها يعني. وهذه أرضنا وإحنا حرين.
All our land was taken behind the war. We raised the case with the Israeli High Court that this is our land and nobody has the right to work in it or to cut it or to keep it away from us. Israeli High Court gave the decision that this is your land, you can grow it, you can do whatever you like. This is your farm, this is your land, so you can do whatever you like in your land. But unfortunately, as you see, there is no gate. We cannot reach it. We cannot do anything. Even the olive trees, we could not this year, we could not even collect the olive fruits.
The reason is that they want us to leave the land. This land is a fertile land. It has a water and all this. So they want to take all the sources of life.
The Israelis want more land. And the Israelis try to confiscate the empty lands from homes. That's why you could notice that the root of the wall is close to the homes. And the agricultural land is behind the law to the Israeli side. They want to make their farming work too difficult and force them to leave the land.
the way the wall is being built now is only going to serve to divide and to build mistrust and miscommunication. And it's going to create a social catastrophe as well as a humanitarian problem.
As I say, everything is uncertain.
World Vision has been working in the occupied territories since 1975. Recently, they've seen increased hardship in the Palestinian communities where they work.
The work of World Vision is to provide hope in the midst of despair, to give people alternatives to feeling despair. The wall is working against that and reading despair in the communities we serve. If we can encourage our governments from a faith-based perspective to take the right position on this wall, it will only be to everyone's interest. It will be to Israel's interest, it will be to the Palestinians' interest, it will be for the U.S. national interest, and for the world's security.
And I hope that the American people, especially in the churches, will pray and will see God's wisdom, and then move into advocacy, write to the congressman or woman, write to the president, write to officials in the Israeli government, and have these officials do their utmost to stop the war. This war will not bring peace. This war will not make good neighbors. This war will not bring security to the Jewish people. It is dividing Palestinians from Palestinians. And of course, it's also dividing Palestinians from Israelis. Not all Palestinians think Israelis are enemies, and not all Israelis think Palestinians are enemies.
Palestinians are not alone in their search for a peaceful solution without a wall. Numerous Israeli groups recognize that the pain of conflict is cyclical.
So first of all, resuming negotiations with the Palestinians because there is a partner. I speak with Palestinians all the time. I go to villages, I go to cities and towns, and you know, there are still people that are willing to speak with us. There are still people that are willing to face some of the most touchy issues like the refugee problem, like, you know, splitting Jerusalem. I think we have to speak with each other, otherwise it won't work. That's the first and foremost step that we have to take.
I'm afraid I don't see eye to eye with the Israeli government about security. I lost my daughter because there was no security. I lost my daughter because there is no peace. I lost my daughter and there is no peace because there is no security. And there is no security because my people oppressing and occupying other people for the last 35 years. I will say there is no forgiveness on earth for the killing of children, of innocent children, no matter what the reason is. If you put your pain on the table trying to show whose pain is bigger, you won't get anywhere. The only way out of this cycle of violence is not looking back, is looking forward.
This is struggle continued more than 50 years now. It's bloodshed continuous every time with the new tools, with the new generations who are victimized from this kind of policy. What should come to the conclusion? This is a track will never reach our future, because naturally you can destroy a very high building in a public building, but to build it, you need years. The same with peace and violence, which means we need more work to build peace between the people.
Susan, did you say it's available through the ELCA website?
No, this is available through the Mennonite Central Committee. I've written information on the board here.
This is a video that was made in February of this year, so you won't see Palestine and Israel any greener than it is in this video. But it's also available on DVD. That has not yet come out. And
and it's about 20 minutes in length?
23 minutes.
23 minutes.
And the DVD also has a film on Jesus walking in the land, so it's two pieces.
So you could use it. It would be a great resource for congregation. So I hope that you'll avail yourself of this. It's you can either buy it, I think, or borrow it, as we have borrowed it this time. I guess I basically have two questions to pose to you out of seeing this, and one is. Can you imagine what it is like for people to feel that they are viewed as so dangerous that they have to be separated from others by a wall? I look at those children looking through the fence and so on, and the image of oneself as there must be something wrong with me if I have to be kept from the rest of the world. You know, how that would work for the people's future. That's one question that I would ask you to think about. And the second one is, given what we see in all of this, what really should be the role of the Christian here and there? What are we summoned out to do here and there? So those are my questions for you. And if you'd like to just respond to the film and make some comments, please do so. As well.
It seems so hopeless on both sides for both peoples. You know, and is that really the last resource? Is that the last thing that they can do is build that wall? It just seems so sad.
Yeah, it's very sad. And it's definitely a sign of hopeless, you know, a hopeless attitude. There are always stories of hope. I really don't want you to leave here thinking that there is no hope there. There are always stories of hope. Just like the 550 individual stories in Jaius that the man referred to, you know, there are also these smaller stories of hope. One is this bereaved parents group, which is made up of both Palestinians and Israelis, and the father of the daughter who lost his daughter by a Palestinian terrorist, meets with Palestinian parents who have lost their children through Israeli terror. So there are those things that are hopeful. They are small.
It seems to me that one of the ways in which we can think about the problem is that I think we need understanding before you can begin to build trust, and you will not make progress until you build trust between the two people. And there's always going to be the issue of the silent majority of the vast population versus the leaders of the country that are leading for whatever reason, not willing to build the kind of trust that's going to serve the population of the most of the issue. One, I think, can make the case that says, yeah, these walls are building, but on the other hand, if you look at it from perhaps the Israelis' perspective, they are surrounded by a wall. They are surrounded by any way they want to go.
By Arab countries.
By other countries, okay. And in terms of where did the first breach in the Green Line occur? Who breached the you know, and for what purpose was it breached? And in terms of the feeling for the land, it's equally important, I think, for the Israelis feel equally strongly about what is their land and historically what has been their land. And I'm not making a case one side or the other, but I think that until one can really understand the feelings of both sides of the issue, the Israelis, why is it that they felt compelled to the very last moment to build the wall? This was not the first option that the Israelis and others have presented, and certainly it is not. I guess if one look at the initiatives to try and resolve the problems, I think there are more initiatives to try and resolve the problems from the Israelis than there have been from the Palestinian or the.
I don't think that's true.
Well, that's not historically true. I guess it all depends on what you mean by initiatives.
Well, I would like to just say that one of the things that I think is important in this film is to recognize the deep love for the land that Palestinians also have. One of the things that we have inherited as part of the story of Israel is that Israel came there. There was really nothing, and the desert bloomed. As a result of Israel being formed, and it flourished, and so on. And certainly, that did happen. There were areas that were irrigated and made, and the land is very important to Israelis and to the Jewish people, certainly. But also to hear that it is so important to the Palestinians as well. They really, the symbol of the olive tree is huge for them, the agricultural life that they have had for centuries is also very significant. Part of the bread or the hope in this is also these people that I just would love to mention them, that Alan and Holly Dines, who you heard were working with the children in that last scene. Are Quakers, and they were such a wonderful part of our congregation at Redeemer. And Alan F. Weaver, who was walking along with the pipe, with the hydrology, the more bulky person, he was part of our, as a head of the Mennonite Central Committee, was our church council president. These are wonderful people, and what I noticed this time when I watched it, that I suddenly thought, you know, why is Catholic Relief Services and the Mennonite Central Committee having to help these pipes be repaired due to the construction of the wall? Why isn't Israel, after constructing the wall, repairing these things? You know, why does this all have to be private? You know, this private assistance.
I don't have any solution. I just, one thing that struck me on the video, in the U.S. we are so jealous of our private property rights, and we live in an area, a lake area, lakefront owners, very jealous, no trespassing sign. And to just imagine your property, and you wake up some morning and there's a bulldozer there. I can't even conceive of it. That's what struck me.
And not only is the bulldozer there, but you aren't going to get any compensation for the land that's being taken.
In fact, often Israel presents in the case of the first scene where we have the impassioned speech in Hebrew by the owner of the house for Israelis to come and see what had happened. Often Israel presents a bill to that homeowner, I don't know in this case, for the cost of demolishing the home. That's not a joke.
That's right.
That's true. And
because it's supposedly illegal, and so they have to come in and take it out, and therefore you have a bill for this.
And in Israel, the density per house is 0.8 persons per room. In the West Bank, it's 2.8 persons per room.
No, the other way around.
No.
No,
that's right. It's 0.8 persons per room.
Oh, 0.8, I'm sorry. I thought you said 8. Okay.
Yeah. Comment on the hope question. As many of us have experienced, I think, when we've gone there to visit, or either short-term study visits or for long-term accompaniment, we get hope from the Palestinians and Israelis who are working for peace and human rights. They give us hope. And one collection of hope stories that is really very well done is by the Palestinian Lutheran pastor in Bethlehem, Mitri Raheb. A new book just appeared, Bethlehem Besieged, Stories of Hope Amid Trouble, I think is the subtitle. And unless they're all gone, it's still in the store. And I commend it to you. And one of the chapters in that book talks about the importance of hope being fed for the Palestinian and Israeli people who are working for a peaceful resolution of the conflict by the presence of internationals, people who come to be with them and to work with them. And there are many examples of how that is happening. And we'll talk in more detail about it tomorrow evening at a forum. There's going to be a forum on...
The forum is going to be tonight.
Oh, it's tonight. Okay, it's tonight. And I encourage you to come to that if you're able after Vespers tonight. But there are many opportunities, largely through the international church community, for internationals to be present, to be givers of hope, supporters of hope, and co-workers with both Palestinian and Israeli people who are seeking a just peace. And there are, you know, some of us have been involved in promoting those efforts, and we'll talk more about that tonight.
Now, we remind the Palestinians and Israelis that they are not alone,
right.
And in turn, we become the recipients of this tremendous gift of hope that if they can go on, we can certainly go on and become advocates for peace in the Middle East.
Is there any chance over there, from your experience, of addressing this issue, whether it's imaginary or not, of the Jewish perception that only their extinction or total removal will resolve the problem? Because as long as that is on the table, we can have all the studies we want, do all the work we want. As long as you don't recognize the sovereignty of the other side, there will be no peace.
The young woman who was speaking, the Israeli young woman, you remember her in the film?
Yeah.
I mean, her plea certainly for her people was to have the conversations with Palestinians, to actually not to realize that they have the same hopes and dreams. That's what has to continue to happen, so that the humanity of the other is always remembered. And
what I heard in that, watching it particularly the second time, was a subtle plea, while there is yet time,
There's
still talk, we can still talk.
Right.
They are still talking to me, and so discerning the time. Now, there's a question. I know that.
I think one assumption that we're making, though, is that Sharon and the Israeli government is reflecting the will of the Jewish people, and my understanding is that that is not the case. That the majority of Israelis, something around 60%, are not in favor of the wall. They're not in favor of what Sharon is doing. And I think that, in that sense, isn't the number of what Americans that do not support the war in Iraq is something, I don't know, 50-60%, I don't know what the number is now. So it's like saying that, you know, we in this room feel as strongly, you know, like I'm not an American, but we don't support the war in Iraq. The majority of Americans don't anymore. And a majority of Israelis do not support what they often will call a right wing. I have a rabbi, colleague that I often imagine sitting beside me at meetings like this, and I always have to keep that perspective in mind. And he says, this, you know, it's a right-wing government and is not reflecting the majority of Israelis. And so I think we always need to remember, just like we don't, you know, the majority of Americans no longer are supporting Iraq. And so then why is it we have these extreme governments that are, you know, not disempowering people, and that people aren't empowered to get their governments to do, you know, I guess people in this room and and in the U.S. feel greatly disempowered, that what can we do? And they're not reflecting our will. So how do we get, you know, the people from the bottom up talking to each other and making change?
When we went on with a group of people who sort of in the international community in Jerusalem, and many of them were working with Palestinians, went with Jeff Helper on a tour of this matrix of control in the Jerusalem area. One of the first things he said to us as an Israeli, he said that we, as internationals, probably had a much better idea of what the Palestinian situation was than any of the Israeli, or many, most Israelis have.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't look for contact. They don't have the strength for that, or something. I don't know what it is. But to have the contact is so threatening that it's not happening in a very regular way, except in these small occurrences.
Which are discouraged and difficult.
And they're making it, it's being made even more difficult, you know, with the physical barriers.
Hans was first.
Yeah.
And then Chuck. Many thoughts are going through my mind. I was raised on the farm, and I empathize with your feelings so beautifully expressed. I can't imagine someone coming with a bulldozer and guns to our land
mm-hmm.
and say, you can't have that anymore. It just kills them. So my motto is, think globally and act locally. And to think globally, I think we have to write our government, whoever your senators and representatives are, when issues come up, for a more neutral position on the part of our government. Our government tends to side with Israel. As far as acting locally, we are involved, we have a Jewish friend who lives in Ein Karim. We are supporting, we've been supporting a Palestinian girl for ever since about 91. And write letters and send significant amounts of money, and supporting an organization called Good Samaritan Ministries, which has established the only drug rehabilitation center in the East, in East Jerusalem, for for Palestinian drug addicts, and they have an incredibly wonderful success rate there. It's just amazing. So I would say we have to search out connections with individuals and maybe support organizations that are making a difference. And then I want to endorse what Chuck was saying. There's nothing like being present. The ministry of presence is enormous, even if it's only a visit. Or like we were in Tantur for 2 months, to know people that are present, this gives them hope. And as you said rightly, we are given hope by what happens in individuals, regardless of what's happening at the macro level. And I think, to me, and my last comment is that Jesus is our wonderful model, because he understands that forgiveness is more important than being right. He models forgiveness. He is our forgiveness. And he didn't wait until the Roman Empire was taken away, in other words, until politics solved everything. He acted immediately in every given situation and was fully present. That's what you guys did. That's what we can do. And somebody wrote a wonderful German book, A Handful of Hope. That's what we can do, is always give handfuls of hope with bread. So that's my last image, the image of bread. The bread is the least expensive thing we can give. But it's when I give you a piece of bread, that's building bridges, regardless of walls and regardless of land. So that's the local level. Think globally, act locally.
To help you think globally and locally, nationally, the Churches for Middle East Peace is a really great resource for us. And Chuck Lutz brought some newsletters from them. They alert us to legislation, actions in the U.S. Congress, it's the Congress that are coming up that you can mobilize behind. And Chuck, maybe would you like to say more about how one does that, or where
or the advocacy days?
The advocacy days, for example, things like that.
Yeah, Churches for Middle East Peace is a coalition of about 20, now 20 Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox Christian denominational groups in the U.S., all of whom have Washington presence, Washington offices for monitoring and lobbying with federal government. ELCA is one of those. And they have come together on the issue of the Middle East agenda, but basically the Holy Land conflict. That's the real focus. And they do organizing in certain states in the U.S., including Minnesota, where I coordinate that work, to do education in local churches, to do lobbying with members of Congress, and at least in my case, to organize group visits to the Holy Land. They're a good resource on what's happening in U.S. policy with regard to the Holy Land, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, for good or ill. And so it's a way of plugging into what's happening in U.S. public policy dimensions in relation to Israel and Palestine. And we can talk some more also about that tonight. But I wanted to offer a couple of observations in response to the comment here about Israeli public policy and support for the Israeli government. Two things. One is I've always been struck when I've been there about the diversity of opinion within Israeli society about any policy issue and the great breadth from left to right of political viewpoint in the Knesset, in public opinion, and the marvelously free press that Israel has to report all of that, far more than we'd ever know in North America. We get the sense in North America that there's an always united Israeli political stance. That's not the case. Sharon's government is a minority government that had to form a coalition with other parties to become a majority group.
There are something like 30 political parties in Israel.
Yeah. And I think the other observation is, in what regard to what you were saying, does the Israeli public support the Sharon government? Well, it depends on what the issue is. If the issue is security, yes, absolutely. I think every Israeli says we need a government that will assure us of being secure. But if the issue is the occupation, no. There's not a majority, I think. It depends on when you take the poll. But if the issue is the settlements and continuing the settlements and expanding the settlements, it's usually a minority of Israelis who say they support that. But the Israeli settlement parties, the parties that support the settlements, have a particularly strong voice in the government because they tend to be the difference between majority and minority status for the ruling government. And
for
so
the
ruling coalition.
Coalition,
yeah.
So
I think there's far more diversity within the Israeli political spectrum on all of these issues than there is, for example, within the American Jewish lobby in the U.S. than you'd ever get a sense of from hearing them, because they tend to go right down the line with whatever the present Israeli government policy is. And right now, that I think the danger is in Israel that the Sharon government coalition might be toppled because of strong opposition from the right to the proposal to abandon Gaza, to leave Gaza. There are right-wing Israeli political movements that don't want to give up any control over any of the Palestinian land. And so it could lead to an even more right-wing Israeli government if that should happen. In other words, Sharon, who was always viewed as from the right, is now viewed more and more as in the middle, more moderate. But it's a fascinating study to look at that.
What can be done from Palestine, and this is probably more of an Arab question, to better advertise what is, I think realistically, the majority feeling of the people. The thing that sticks in my mind, and I think it sticks in a lot of American mind, is after 9/11, immediately after, to see thousands and thousands of Arabs dancing in the street, rejoicing at that tragedy, which at that point in time made it like to nuke them all. And until they get out their message that Arafat and the radicals, who they do not support, hold the limelight, this undercurrent of peace seems to be stifled.
Mm-hmm. That's a really unfortunate visual image.
Yeah, and I don't recall that there were thousands. We were greeted by thousands of people, Palestinians, telling us how sorry they were, how sorrowful they were, over and over again.
But that didn't get on CNN.
Yeah, there were images, I understand, on television, some from East Jerusalem, Palestinian Jerusalem, and then we heard all sorts of things that may or may not be true, that kids were given candy and so on. But yes, that was, if that happened, that was very unfortunate.
Because that puts us in a place where we can appreciate Israel's harsh response to
that, and that's exactly what Israel wanted. After September 11th, they said, now you know how we feel. Dan?
Yeah, I have this memory that a notice came immediately after 9/11 from the Lutheran Church, that the image we saw of Palestinians rejoicing in the streets was very isolated.
Yes. From the Palestinian Lutherans, this came.
Palestinian. It was very isolated and did not represent at all even a large minority, but it gave the impression that the Palestinians were rejoicing when those who were there, the Lutherans that saw it, said most Palestinians.
I think after 9/11, we had the sympathy of virtually the whole world, and that sympathy has really been squandered in the last.
Because this is an Arab, and more an Arab, not solely Palestinian. Every time in your life when they beheaded those and dragged those innocent workers through the streets and beheaded them like that. I mean, it might just be a few people that it's magnified, but I think if there's going to be peace in this, we have to let the majority of people that want to live together in peace, and I have no doubt that the Palestinians and the Arabs, the vast majority want to just get along. But how do we overcome the minority that seems to capture all of the news and all of it?
Yeah. Is there an American policy on the wall? Has the American government taken a position on the wall?
We have said it's not helpful. Not helpful to the peace process. Building it inside Palestinian territory is not helpful to the peace process.
This is some of the strongest language that America uses.
Yeah.
I just was taken
toward Israel is to say something is not helpful.
I was just taken aback at I managed old folks home, and we have a large screen deal larger than this, and we had President Reagan's the whole event. We just did it, and I was amazed at how our residents just the kind of respect for President Reagan and his death, and then there was the couple times when they played the speech, and I have to say I was just kind of taken aback when he said, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down
this wall." I mean
the hair stuff, and as we talked to residents, and they said, you know, you can argue whatever you want, but if it wasn't for Ronald Reagan, you know, the Soviet Union would not have fallen, and neither would have this wall. But I mean, when he said that speech, NPR did this deal where with the speechwriter, where the actual speechwriter said that Reagan's staff did not want that line in that speech, and that he did that. And I was just taken back, so I watched it. I thought, I don't really know that I know that full story, but I was, the hair stood up for me when he said that. I thought,
Is there a link there at all?
Well, I have a question. I'm wondering exactly what the U.S.'s attachment is to not taking
that kind of a stand in it with Israel and saying, hey, you know, shape up. And why are we being, what interest do we have really in being more sort of tap dancing around their sensitivities? Because really, the reason why they have any strength at all is because we fund them. It's not like we have anything to fear from them.
It's a really important question.
But our congresspeople have something to fear in terms of being reelected.
Yes, it's a strong Jewish lobby and a strong Jewish
vote. But even when we have agreements, I think there was a tacit agreement that a plan where the wall will go into even further in the Palestinian areas around some settlement blocks. We had an, I think, maybe Chuck, you know, I think there was an agreement that Israel would suspend that building process if they were going right ahead.
Yeah, in the recent meeting between Sharon and Bush, there was some agreement to at least hold back on part of the wall construction.
We told Sharon to move his troops out of the West Bank during a re-invasion in spring 2002, and that didn't happen.
We hear from members of Congress, our own in some cases, and from Churches for Middle East Peace, that even more influential today with Congress than the Jewish lobby is the Christian Zionist movement, and which Bush seems to feel is the Christian fundamentalist evangelical movement, which he seems to feel is a central part of his base for re-election, and that's another factor. It's not just the American Jewish lobby, which is still powerful, both in terms of voice and in terms of dollars for members of Congress. And they've been known to defeat some members of Congress who didn't vote right on Israel. Paul Findlay from Illinois is a notable example of that. But I think both the Christian Zionist lobby and the American Jewish lobby are powerful forces and have been, and they have every right, you know, to push for what they believe in. But there's no countervailing force.
The Arabs in the U.S. need to organize. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How about one last comment back here? Perhaps we have time for one.
Always been distressing to me how much aid we give to Israel, and I've never quite understood, except that it's all about money, apparently, and support and re-election. But what if we cut back our aid to Israel? I mean, that would be pretty severe and dramatic, I suppose.
I've asked my own House member, Martin Sabo, who's a fellow ELCA Lutheran, that very question. He's on the House Appropriations Committee and a fairly senior member. I've said, Martin, why can't we at least put conditions on our aid? There are no conditions on our aid to Israel. All of our other foreign aid has conditions. It has to be used in certain ways. And why can't we at least say for the coming period of aid, we will reduce it by the amount that is spent on wall construction or on settlement expansion? And Marty's response is, Chuck, that's a great idea, but it'll never happen. The votes are not there.
So that's Kent's barbershop idea. Well, it was a great idea, but it got shot down after he cut some.
But it won't happen.
Why won't it happen?
I know the barbershop, sir. I want to know why it wouldn't happen. Chuck.
The votes aren't there.
The votes.
There's no possibility of getting a majority of the House or Senate to vote any kind of conditions to our aid package to Israel.
And it is because of the Christian Zionists and the Jewish lobby?
Another example, this time a congressperson in the Holy Land who was at our Easter sunrise service, who I had dinner with a group of people from Save the Children, and meeting in Jerusalem where the Save the Children organization had all their regional heads within the West Bank, all Palestinians, all had managed to get in. And they just told their daily life story to Christopher Shea from Connecticut. And he had just been in Iraq without any security and without really much security in the West Bank. And he was tremendously moved by these stories of personal hardship that were daily, even habitual in a sense. And he pledged that he would take those stories back to Washington. And as far as I can tell from his voting record and what he has said in Congress, he hasn't changed at all. And one of our State Department diplomats in the congregation who also heard him said, I just know what's going to happen when he gets in a room full of AIPAC people, that it's just overwhelming.
AIPAC is American-Israel Public Affairs Committee.
You start getting the questions fast and furious, and are you soft on terrorism, and so on.
He also asked, was this a setup that each of these people had such dramatic stories to tell?
But he was sort of joking,
But it wasn't. It was just their ordinary life.
Yeah, I think something would help any more than a weekend. We are limited what we can do in that situation. I don't fault this country through several administrations to try to bring peace to that region. But I think until the Palestinians can elect a leader that speaks for the silent majority, or one that can be perceived as being trustworthy, the wall will stand. I think that wall could come down in a hurry if there was ever any honest movement towards peace.
Can I just reframe, though? I think that is a comment that is often heard, and there is a quality of truth to that. But let me just reframe it. There's no way that an election in the West Bank can happen. The Israelis have so divided that the land. I mean, just to try to begin the process of working towards an election is very difficult. Even given all the PLO problems, our government has been funding people to work for years on developing democracy in the West Bank. And Israel, beginning in the spring of 2002, have simply made it impossible. The Palestinian legislature cannot even meet.
Which is an elected legislative body. They can't gather. They can't get together.
So it would be great to have a true election to elect Palestinian leaders representing their country and representing a vision for peace and justice. But it won't happen until Israel is the controlling power, until Israel decides that they are going to essentially let go of their domination.
You know, I think an answer to some of the issues about the funding and this type of thing, I think that at least there is a perception that Israel is the one foothold in the Middle East, and that if the United States... And if United States gives the appearance of backing away from the funding of it, or backing away from the military assistance and the funding of it, that to the extent that there are those who believe that there is a Muslim and Arab terrorism conspiracy to take Israel out of the equation. That if we back away from the funding and back away from any of that and suggest in whatever way that politically we're pulling away from supporting Israel, this will do nothing more than embolden these people who are bent on the destruction. Now, whether that's a rational, whether that is in fact a conspiracy theory or whether it's in fact, I don't know. But that's what you continue to hear in some quarters in terms of the whole issue of funding of Israel.
I should say that at one point there was an example, mostly symbolic, I guess, but there was an example of U.S. withholding of economic support to Israel. It was George Bush the first, who reduced the amount of our loan guarantees. See, in addition to our straight-out aid, we provide loan guarantees, right, which puts the credibility of the United States Treasury behind Israel's getting money on the international money market, which means they can borrow at a lower rate. And George Bush in the early, I think it was about 91, right, 92, before Bill Clinton came into office, reduced the amount of loan guarantee from like $8 billion to $6 billion or something, as a symbolic word to Israel to stop developing settlements. So it has happened. I mean, even though it was largely symbolic.
Yeah, it did have an effect, too.
It sent a signal to Israel. It made a statement to Israel.
Let's let Karin have the last word, and then we'll release you, and then Susan and I will be glad to talk with anybody that wants to stay.
So the last word is just that thanks for bringing this film and letting us know where it is, because I think it's so very important for all of us to have some other visual images of Palestinians and Israelis than the ones that we get on TV or photos even in magazines or newspapers.
I just have the highest respect for the Mennonites.
Well, yes. And it's important for, you know, if all of our churches can show that film and so that people hear other stories, or if we can listen to the voices that come from the Lutheran Church and in other Christian churches in Palestine, and to hold those up, because we need alternative voices and visions and images.
So thank you.
It's in matching funds.
Yeah, in matching funds.
Thank you. Thank you very much.